Marshall, please open court.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Frisch, Judge Hallbrooks, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes, Jr. presiding.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone, and good morning. Today is Thursday, November 4th, 2021. We have four cases on our calendar for today, the third of which is set for oral argument, which is this one right here, A21-0641. In re the estate of Richard Koborowski, and my apologies if I mispronounce that. I'll rely on counsel to help with the pronunciations of that name and some of the other names in the file. We are holding this via zoom.gov, so we are holding these arguments virtually. Thank you both, and thank you for all the participants for accommodating us in this fashion. We are recording this orally. No other recordings are permitted of these proceedings. All the rules of court apply except for having to stand, obviously, because we're doing it virtually. We don't have to worry about that. But all other rules of decorum are to be followed. Respondent and appellant both will have 15 minutes for their initial arguments. And there's a clock there. You should be able to see that. So make sure you keep track of that so you stay within your time limit. And then appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so choose. I think that covers just about everything. One other thing I should mention is if we do run into any technical issues at all, we will make sure that we accommodate the parties and try to address them at that time. Sounds like both of you have a good connection. We can see you and we can hear you. If for some reason you have difficulties, sometimes what works is taking the video off. We've seen that happen sometimes with people, especially if there's not a strong connection. But if anything comes up, we'll try to address it at that time. So with that, counsel for appellant, please state your name for the record and the party you're representing, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Kenneth White. I'm an attorney in Mankato, and I represent appellant Peter Koborowski. And Judge, you got that name correct. I think the other one that may cause a little tongue twisting is Richard Cataldi. He's one of the attorneys who was involved in drafting the estate plan for Dick Koborowski. Your Honors, we're here on appeal from a summary judgment or the grant of summary judgment. And that's significant because throughout their brief, the respondents referred to clear error, which clearly is not the standard of review here. And so this court needs to begin by starting with the correct standard of review, that from an appeal for from summary judgment. None of the parties have raised any significant issues of material fact. And I think that's significant as we go through the district court opinion and the three steps of the analysis here, which really is focused on the error of the application of law by the trial court.
And Mr. White?
Yes.
If it's okay, I'd actually like to stop you there because you say that there are not any issues of material fact, but it seems as if both parties are arguing over the facts and the inferences from the facts. Isn't it the case that there actually are issues of material fact in dispute between the parties?
Well, Your Honor, I think there are disputes about the inferences that can be drawn from some of the issues of disputed fact. But those inferences and fact disputes only become material are only significant is if, under the summary judgment standard, they are material to the ultimate decision that the court makes. And so I think it's important for the court to examine each of the three issues. And as you do that, you'll see that any of those factual disputes or inference disputes are not, in fact, material to the ultimate resolution of this case.
Well, I think the primary dispute is whether the testator revoked his will. And there are disputes as to whether he revoked the will.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think there are disputes about whether he revoked his will under the legal construct. The problem here is that the district court erred in its analysis of the legal construct. And that error is what results in the need to reverse this case. And the problem is, if you go to the first step of the analysis, the legal analysis, which is whether there is the necessary proof of this presumption or inference, and that proof requires two elements. First, that the will cannot be found. That is undisputed. The original will is not found. Strikingly, the district court found or stated on at least three occasions that the will was lost, not that it was revoked, not that Dick Kobarowski did anything to destroy or revoke the will as required under statute, but that the will was lost. That factual finding is not significantly challenged before this court. The second element, and the one where the dispute arose, is whether it was in the possession of the testator. And again, it's significant, Your Honor, that the burden of establishing the presumption is on the respondents here.
Mr. White,
yes.
Just to clarify, I mean, isn't it accurate to say that whether or not the decedent had possession of the will is a disputed fact?
I don't think so, Your Honor, if you look at the entirety of the record. There is no direct evidence that the respondent or that the decedent, Dick Kobarowski, ever held his will. There's no testimony from an attorney about handing it over to him. There's no discussion of any of the family members. None of the children claim that they know that Dick Kobarowski possessed the will at any time. So there's no direct testimony. So we're left with inferences from other testimony. And what are the inferences that the appellants relied on? They are all that have equal opposite inferences, which means they're not sufficient under our standards for challenging or for establishing proof of the particular point. It is.
And I don't want to argue with you, but aren't you saying, in essence, that respondents say he possessed it, even though you get to possession in their argument by inference, and you're saying there was no possession and there's no evidence of possession?
Well, Your Honor, I that's certainly the argument that the parties are making. But what this court has to do and what the district court failed to do, because the district court undertook no analysis of possession at all. It doesn't appear anywhere in the district court order. So what we're left to do is to analyze the record and determine whether there is any evidence in the record that would establish possession. And I think if this court looks at it, even in allowing some inferences to be drawn, there are equal and opposite inferences from each piece of evidence.
Mr. White,
yes.
You said that the district court made no analysis whatsoever of the possession element.
Yes, Your Honor.
And if that is the case, isn't that a legal error by the district court requiring reversal in and of itself right there?
I don't think so, Your Honor, unless that legal error by the district court is material to the ultimate review by this court of the grant of summary judgment.
Well, why isn't that material? Because it seems that if an element is missing, if the district court did not find an element met, then it almost seems like it's kind of like a house of cards, because the district court granted summary judgment based on the presumption of revocation being met. And as you noted, that requires at least two elements being met, one of which is showing possession by the decedent. And if there's no finding whatsoever by the district court of whether decedent even possessed the original will, isn't that legal error right there?
Certainly, it's legal error, Your Honor, and that's our argument. The question is, what is the impact in this court's analysis of that legal error? And on the one hand, that could lead to a remand with a directive to the district court to specifically address possession. But that remand issue or option only arises if there is some evidence in the record that would establish that there is a fact dispute over possession. So if this court reviews the record.
Well, isn't that Peter's testimony? I mean, Ms. Peter testifies that he saw Dad with the envelope go to the insurance agent at, with Mom's will too, to get an insurance policy. And so he's testifying that he had it in his possession at some point in time.
Your Honor, I disagree. The record doesn't support that. And if you look at our reply brief, I cite the specific language from, I think it's pages 14 and 15 of Peter Koborowski's deposition where that envelope is discussed. And what Peter Koborowski talks about in his deposition is that maybe the insurance, life insurance policies were in the envelope, but he doesn't know what was in it. And so any claim that when they went to the insurance agent that the wills were contained in that envelope is pure speculation.
He testified, and it's on pages 22 to 24 of his deposition, and I have it in front of me. He testified that he didn't know that he didn't know exactly what was in the envelope, but the discussion that was had with the insurance agent was with respect to the wills, and that he believed that based on that discussion, he had the wills with him when he went to the insurance agent. Now, I'm not saying that this is, you know, the actual possession of the wills was proved by direct evidence, but isn't there something in the record from which a reasonable fact finder could conclude that at some point in time, this testator had his will in his possession, and that time would be when he went to go see the insurance agent, which then creates a question of fact as to whether he possessed the will.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. Even with that testimony, all Peter is saying is that the envelope was there and they talked about the will. There's no testimony there that anybody opened the envelope in his presence and he observed the wills. So Peter is speculating about what might have been in the envelope. There are lots of other things that might have been in the envelope. And that kind of speculation carries over into lots of other bases upon which the respondents have asserted that they've proved possession and the revocation of the will in this case. That there's an empty envelope from a law firm in the safe. And respondents take that and assert that, therefore, the original will was revoked. Well, that law firm didn't exist until 2010.
What about this fact? So at the time that his wife passed in 2008, he had her will, a copy of her will. And it's also true that they executed their wills together. Wouldn't it be a reasonable inference from those facts that at that time he also had his own will since he was able to produce his wife's?
No, Your Honor, that would not, because there's no direct testimony that he possessed her will in 2008. The likelihood, given the family relationship as testified to by the children, is that Sheila was the one who possessed the wills and kept track of those documents. But if all he had was a copy of the will, of his wife's will in 2008, then the most logical inference is all he has is a copy of his will in 2008, not the original. So all of that, again, points to this lack of any evidence in this record to establish possession. And absent any evidence in the record that would establish possession, meet the requirement by a preponderance of the evidence of proof of possession, the failure of the district court to address the issue is not material to this court, and the presumption simply falls aside. But even if this court finds that there's a fact issue around possession and thinks it needs to be remanded, the presumption is rebutted without any significant factual dispute. The function of a presumption in Minnesota is very explicit. Once there is substantial countervailing evidence, the presumption disappears. It becomes completely invalid. And so when the presumption here, even if it exists, vanishes because there is substantial countervailing evidence. Peter Koborowski testified that his father said the will was lost. there's this colloquy that occurs through Richard Tackleby in his letters about the existing estate plan, nothing about dying intestate or anything similar to that. Sheila's will was probated in 2008 with a photocopy, not with the original. All of that points to substantial countervailing evidence to defeat the presumption. And most significantly, the trial court found the will was lost in a factual finding that has not been significantly challenged here. If the will was lost in 2008, then the only thing that can be true is that it was somehow found between 2008 and Dick Kobarowski's death, and that he then revoked it, took the physical act of revoking the will by tearing it, by marking on it, doing something as required by Minnesota law. And there's simply no evidence in this record of that. And so you end up, even if this court finds a factual dispute about the presumption, the next step is the presumption been rebutted. There's no factual dispute about that, and it in fact has. And so then we get to the grant of summary judgment without the benefit of the presumption. The trial court, of course, did not address that. But I think if this court examines the record, you'll find that the statements made are simply insufficient to establish that the will was revoked. There's no direct testimony, and the indirect testimony has multiple inferences of equal weight and therefore are insufficient to establish the prima facie case as is required by or proof
Mr. White, of the evidence. Yes, yeah. Yeah, Mr. White, let's assume for the sake of argument that we agree with you that there's no prima facie case that had been made of revocation. Doesn't that still, don't respondents still have the opportunity to argue revocation? Because if there is an issue of material fact that is in dispute with respect to whether or not any actions were taken,
well, Your Honor, there is, I see my time's about up. Can I answer the court's question?
Please.
Thank you. Your Honor, there is no evidence in the record to establish any physical act. No one saw any physical act or testified.
Right. Let me stop you right there, Mr. White, if I could stop you right there. I understand your argument there. I think what I'm trying to get at is that, you know, they would have to make a prima facie case. And if they make a prima facie case, and then your client has the opportunity to rebut it, but if we agree with you that they did not make a prima facie case, then we don't have to get into the prima facie case and rebuttal. But because the parties are arguing over issues of fact in terms of inferences that can be made based on observations or statements, it doesn't appear that there's any direct evidence, but in terms of inferences, doesn't respondent still have that opportunity to make the arguments based on the inferences of this is how the inferences we make from the facts, and then you can argue here are the inferences that we make from the facts? Because I think you said earlier you could interpret some of these two different ways.
Yes, Your Honor. But again, the legal standard becomes the critical issue here. And the legal standard is that one of those inferences has to predominate. If two equally likely inferences exist, that's insufficient to grant summary judgment, and it's insufficient to make out the prima facie case. And here, if all we're left with is inferences that go either way, then the respondents in any circumstance cannot prevail. And in fact, this court should reverse, if we ask, reverse this case and remand it to grant summary judgment on behalf of Peter Kobarowski, allowing the 1993 will to be probated.
Thank you. And you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, please state your name for the record and the party you're representing, and you have 15 minutes as well.
Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. I'm Joseph Ganji. I represent the respondents in this matter. Our respondents are, along with Joe Kobarowski, who's separately represented here by Attorney Friedrichs, are a group of 6 out of 7 siblings who, after their dad passed away, sought a determination that their dad died without a will. Appellant being the one sibling who disagreed with that, and he sought to probate a copy of a 1993 will that their dad drafted. this issue was presented to the district court on a summary judgment record, and the district court determined that summary judgment was appropriate for respondents. And that decision should be affirmed for at least two reasons. First,
Mr. Ganji, before you start there, I want to go to the standard of review, because you argue in your brief repeatedly that the standard of review is clear error, but isn't this that doesn't seem like the appropriate standard of review for summary judgment.
Yes, and that's kind of an interesting question too, Your Honor, because what we're dealing with is the presumption and whether to apply it. And that's not necessarily subject to your typical, are there genuine issues of material fact? The decision to apply, for example, you have inferences that are made and a presumption is established. Inferences are based on the facts, and here the facts are undisputed, and the district court used those facts and determined that a presumption should apply. So under the Botko case, the court did that same thing, and it looked like a clearly erroneous standard.
But that Botko case was not a summary judgment case.
Correct. Correct.
And so that's a very, very different, and Langley as well. Those are very different cases. What we have here is a summary judgment motion. And so our standard of review is governed by what we do on a summary judgment motion. And we review that de novo. And I think importantly here, we review the facts and we review the evidence, I should say, in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. And in that case, it would be appellant.
Your Honor, I think in this case, and specifically the decision of the district court, whether or not to apply the presumption is subject to a different standard.
Right. You have to start with the overarching standard of review with a summary judgment motion being granted.
Correct. You're looking at a summary judgment motion, but the very first question is the district court's decision to apply the presumption of revocation. And that decision itself is based on Mr. White's reply brief, I took a little bit more research into this. It actually may be a discretionary decision. And this case, in a subsequent decision, the estate of Chisholm, and that's cited at 2018 Westlaw 492614, looked at that specific decision of the district court to apply the presumption. And it stated that here, the original 2010 will was not probated, and the district court acted within its proper scope of discretion in determining there was a presumption that the original will was revoked. So I think if you're looking at that, certainly there are facts that go into it, but if those facts are undisputed, then the decision is, okay, well, the district court is permitted to apply a presumption. Did it abuse its discretion in doing so? And it certainly did not here.
Well, why didn't it abuse its discretion? It didn't even analyze the possession element.
The court can certainly look at the district court's order and infer that finding. The district court looked at the element of possession. It stated some facts, and then by applying the presumption, clearly it meant to make that finding. And then it went on to see if the presumption was rebutted.
But the district court didn't make. I think we have to be very careful in terms of when we can imply that there's a finding. But here, there's clearly no finding or a finding of fact to support the possession element. Isn't that legal error right there?
No, Your Honor, because the undisputed facts line up very squarely with the Botko case. Botko case, you have the will is gone. It's lost. It's missing. It's just the original will is not there. And then you have evidence that no one else possessed it at any time. Those two undisputed.
So let me stop you right there. Did you say that nobody possessed the wills at any time?
No one else other than the decedent has ever been shown to be in possession of the will.
Okay, but that's a separate issue. I don't think that that's actually applicable to this situation. Here in this situation, you have reciprocal wills. Can you please point to me, and when Sheila died in 2008, nobody could find the original will. All they could find was a copy in the attorney's office. Can you point to any evidence any facts in the record to show that he ever possessed that will, the original copy of the will, the original of the will?
Your Honor, as far as that goes, I would go back to Peter Kobrowski's testimony about going to the insurance. But I'd also indicate to the court that that particular possession element is not a concrete element that must be met. If you look at the Botko case, the presumption applies if no one other than the decedent is ever shown to be in possession, in which case that inference can be made that, okay, well, the decedent must have possessed it because nobody else has it. And the district court at that point is within its proper scope of discretion in applying the presumption.
Mr. Ganji, I respectfully disagree with you in your interpretation of having to look to see whether or not anybody else did. I think we need to look at whether decedent ever possessed the original will. What evidence is there that he, what are the facts that show that he possessed the original will?
As far as those facts go, Your Honor, we have Peter Kobrowski's testimony with the insurance. We've got...
Okay, let's stop right there then. His testimony is that his father brought an envelope. He did not know what the contents were in that envelope. That's pure speculation as to whether it was a will, whether it was a copy of a will, whether it was an original of the will, whether it were there were insurance documents or something else, or the envelope was empty. There's no evidence there that he actually had the original will in that envelope.
I disagree that that's speculation, Your Honor. When the decedent brings an envelope to an insurance agency, certainly he's not bringing the insurance forms to the insurance agency. He's going to the insurance agency to get forms, and he's using the will in order to do that as part of his estate planning process. That envelope from an attorney's office, certainly that certainly is evidence that he's got the will. And then in connection with Karen Atkinson's testimony too, that, yep, they were talking about the will in connection with going to the insurance company.
So I don't disagree with you, counsel, that that's certainly a reasonable inference that a fact finder could make from that evidence, but it's also a reasonable inference that maybe he just had a copy of the will, especially since he only had a copy of Sheila's will too at the time that she died. So why isn't that a fact dispute with respect to the application of the presumption?
With application of the presumption, again, when we're looking at how that presumption arises, I go back right to the Botko case where we don't have that evidence of possession in Botko either. We have specifically only evidence that no one other than decedent had possession. And that is enough to apply the presumption. And that's
Mr. Ganji, let me stop you there with respect to Botko. You keep going back to that, but that was not a summary judgment case. Here, we have to look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. And as Judge Frisch points out, let's assume for the sake of argument that there are two reasonable interpretations. One reasonable interpretation of those facts is that he did not have his will with him, or another is that he only had a copy of it. He didn't have the original will. The same as what happened when Sheila died. Nobody was able to locate the original will. We have to look at that evidence in light most favorable to the non-moving party, which here would be Peter. It seems like the district court erred here by not viewing the evidence in light most favorable to him as the non-moving party.
And I would respectfully disagree with that standard, Your Honor, as you're looking at the decision itself to apply the presumption. I think that is a different type of decision that's outside the summary judgment context. It's made regardless of
where summary judgment motion.
Absolutely. Whether it's a
summary judgment motion, then summary judgment standard applies. And that means we have to look at all the evidence in light most favorable to the non-moving party.
And again, I would disagree with that. As far as the application of the presumption and whether or not to apply the presumption, which it's a discretionary decision by the district court. And once the presumption is applied, then the burden of production shifts over to the proponent of the will to establish some kind of evidence of non-revocation, as counsel said, substantial countervailing evidence. And here the district court found the presumption applicable based on the summary judgment record. And that certainly is supported by the summary judgment record. And so that switches over then to that burden of production to appellant. Now, if the court were to disagree on the application of the presumption, or whether the presumption applies or whether it doesn't apply, or whether it was rebutted or not rebutted, that doesn't end the case, because certainly you don't need a presumption in order to prove revocation. Instead, you just go forward without application of a presumption, and you just have your summary judgment record, and the burden of persuasion then just simply remains with the respondents here, the proponents of intestacy. And so that record would have to be analyzed either summary judgment wise, or if you have a hearing by findings of fact. So we made cross motions on summary judgment. The district court never actually reached that decision based on its finding that appellant never rebutted the presumption. So the presumption being non-rebutted, basically respondents met their burden simply by that alone. But absent the presumption, the next step would be to look at the summary judgment record and determine whether there are genuine issues of material fact or not, as you're looking at the decision of revocation. Respondents believe there are not genuine issues of material fact and that they were entitled to summary judgment as a matter of law, notwithstanding the presumption, based on the myriad facts that I've indicated in the brief. And the facts to the contrary are basically silence from decedent. For example, you have Margaret Kobrowski's testimony that she thought decedent was happy with his estate plan. And she got that impression based on decedent's smile. So she's talking about, hey, you should put these land in trust. Decedent never followed up with her, never said anything to her except a smile. And her response, or her impression was, okay, well, that must mean he's happy with his estate plan, whatever that happens to be. That doesn't raise a genuine issue of material fact that the will is not revoked. Similar to appellant when he testified that the only reason he thinks the will is still valid is because decedent never told him otherwise.
But what is the actual evidence of affirmative revocation? I mean, we know he had a will at one point in time. We know he was concerned about what was in his will. We know he communicated with his lawyer from time to time about changing his will. And we know he said at some point in time, my will was lost and I don't have a will. But that's different than an affirmative revocation under the statute.
Your Honor, I think the appellant takes the legal standard a bit too far. It seems like appellant is requiring for example, here, the district court to make a specific finding that decedent performed this specific act on the will at this specific time. And that's not required for a finding of revocation. You can certainly have a number of other evidence together.
I don't disagree with you, but I'm asking, what is the actual evidence that he intended to revoke the will, did revoke the will? It seems to me that there's a reasonable inference from this record that there was inaction by the testator.
What we have is specifically discussions with his attorney about the will and a new plan, and how if he did nothing, that intestacy would control. Everything would be distributed equally, which is inconsistent with the will. His attorney would not say that unless there was no will. I see my time is up. May I quickly finish?
Please.
And I think that's very significant evidence. And then we have that consistent statement ever since that time, especially in 2018 and before, when his brother died, talking to his children and saying, I don't have a will, when asked that specific question, acknowledging, I don't have a will. And then all my documents are going to be in one spot. The kids found that spot. There is no will there. There's a number of other, there certainly is inaction, and under the Langley case, inaction can prove revocation. And I think when you put all that together, there's no other way that you can decide the case, which is why I asked for summary judgment. And I see my time has expired. Thank you very much.
Counsel, I do have one additional question for you.
So do I, Judge, when you have a moment.
Okay, sure. And my question relates to the statute that Judge Frisch referred to, and I'm looking specifically at Minnesota Statutes 524.2-507 on revocation by writing or by an act. And it makes it clear under subdivision A that a will can be revoked one of two ways, by executing a subsequent will. And that is not the case here. He never did execute a subsequent will. But also it can be revoked by, quote, by performing a revocatory act on the will. And it lists acts such as burning, tearing, canceling, obliterating, or destroying the will. What evidence is there in the record of that decedent performing a revocatory act, such as destroying or burning or tearing or canceling or obliterating the will?
I would say all of the evidence that I've described is an act of canceling a will. And the act of canceling the will itself, that's a revocatory act. And certainly—
How does it fit into those definitions, the statutory definitions of what the revocatory act is? It has to be some type of physical act.
And that raises an interesting question, though, Your Honor, as far as if you have a will that's gone, how can you possibly perform a physical act on that document? We don't know whether he found it and did an act on it, which is one of the big reasons why we have the presumption. But certainly you'd be able to infer from the record and from decedent's own conduct and statements that he did perform a revocatory act on the will. We just don't know what it was. And that certainly—
Okay, so we don't know what the revocatory act was. There's nothing in the record of a revocatory act.
Well, I would say that the act is potentially canceling the will based on his conduct. But again, if there's nothing specific in the record, we can certainly infer such an act based on the conduct and the statements and all of the evidence.
And Judge Hallbrooks, you had a question?
Yeah, this is kind of, it's kind of going to take us too far afield at this point, but here's what concerns me, Mr. Ganji. It seems you argued to the district court on the cross motions for summary judgment that the presumption applied and that Peter did not adequately rebut it. But your argument today, and you made, I believe, to the district court was, even if the presumption does not apply, we still prevail on summary judgment because of revocation. But the district court's decision was resting entirely on application of the presumption of revocation. So it seems to me if we disagree with that for any reason, and I'm not speaking for the panel or even myself at this point, but should we disagree with that, that's the only basis this court decided this on. So it seems to me it would have to go back on remand for a trial because you don't get a second opportunity to say, okay, Judge, that wasn't the right basis for summary judgment, but this one is. Am I incorrect in that?
Partly, Your Honor. We did make the summary judgment motion was based on both grounds. It was the presumption that controls, but in the event that the presumption is rebutted, that goes away and you're basically left with the summary judgment record. And our argument to the district court was there are no genuine issues of material fact on the issue, and so respondents would be entitled to a determination as a matter of law. And the district court
did
not—
But you agree that was not the basis for its decision.
That was not the basis for the district court's decision. Okay. This court certainly can affirm on any grounds consistent with the record, and that's why that was brought up as an alternative.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions from the panel? Okay, thank you. Mr. White, you will have the last word for 5 minutes. Mr. White, you're on mute.
My apologies, Your Honor. We try to do this right all the time and don't always succeed. Council places heavy reliance on BOTCO and specifically on the language out of BOTCO that there is no evidence that someone else possessed the will in BOTCO. The problem with that analysis is it ignores the facts in BOTCO, and specifically it ignores the fact that the will was at some point in the possession of the of Ms. BOTCO. And so once it is determined that, so you start with that initial assessment of BOTCO and all the rest of these cases where there is something in the record that says at some point in time, the testator possessed the will and then it disappeared. And so we're left with a significant distinction, I think, from those cases. The second thing I think that is significant here, Your Honor, as you're evaluating the district court decision and its application of the presumption, the district court committed the legal error in applying the presumption because the district court said that Peter did not present evidence that would rise to the level of a preponderance of the evidence. That's not the standard, and that's at A7 of the record. That's not the standard here. The standard here instead is whether there is some evidence, some substantial evidence submitted that would defeat the presumption. And once that is done, the presumption disappears. And so we're left with a straight up summary judgment analysis. And this court has discussed that at some length. And there, first of all, Judge Hallbrooks, you're correct. The district court never dug into that. But as counsel acknowledged, any alternative basis can be used by this court in its analysis of the that was presented to the trial court and appears from the record in affirming summary judgment. And that's what we want this court.
Can I focus on that evidence for a moment? I want to get back to the question of revocation. So Mr. Ganji noted one fact that I'm particularly focused on that was presented to the district court. And that is in the discussions between counsel and the testator, later in time, when he was thinking about a new estate plan, counsel said that if you die without a will, you will die intestate. So that would suggest to me that the inference from that evidence would be that he has no estate plan at that point in time. Is there some evidence to indicate that fact is not true? Some dispute, Honor, about that.
I think, Your Honor, that the problem with that analysis is that you have to look at the totality of the letters from Attorney Cackledy to his client, Mr. Koborowski. And if you do that, it is clear that it was everybody's understanding that there was the 1993 will was still valid at this time. Understand the history of this. This is after Sheila Koborowski has passed and they probate the copy of the will. But the Cackledy letters talk about the your previous document and make reference to some of the provisions in that will. And then in the June 30th, 2009 letter, there's a specific reference to your current estate plan. Well, lawyers don't talk about current estate plans when they're talking about intestacy. They say the statute says this is what's going to happen. They don't talk about current estate plan. And then the May 3rd, 2010 letter goes on to say, we need to examine your estate plan, not intestacy, your estate plan to minimize taxes. All of that points to, if you read the totality of the letters, to the absence of any evidence in this record of revocation. And again, as Mr. Ganji noted, there is simply nothing in this record to show a physical act on the will or its physical destruction. Instead, what we have are comments like, there is the potential that it was done, or it could have happened, or we could infer it. Well, I don't think that gets you, certainly not to the point of summary judgment, and I don't even think it gets you to a preponderance of the evidence to defeat summary judgment on the other side on behalf of Peter Koborowski and the admission of the 1993 will. And so we would ask this court to do that.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you very much for your brief and your oral arguments. I'm getting a little bit of an echo here. Hopefully you're not. But we will take the matter under advisement. We will be issuing an order within the statutory 90-day timeframe. That is our last case set for oral argument. With that, the court is in recess.